This is CliffCentral.com. Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Ramon is present. And Jonathan, I must be honest, yesterday I went to go see a dentist, a very nice, big, burly man. And he took
Did he have toxic masculinity?
Well,
does he shave with Gillette?
He doesn't shave at all by the looks of it when I last saw him. No.
That's terrible.
So very toxic. But what is not toxic is his ability to wrench a tooth out of my mouth with vicious force.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, while that was happening, I thought, this is a lot more interesting than reading the ANC manifesto.
Well, yes. Most things are more interesting and less painful than involving yourself with the ANC.
I mean, I wonder, did anyone in the stadium actually...
People don't go to stadiums to listen to the policy. They go to stadiums for free T-shirts and sometimes food parcels.
That's racist.
That's how this works. I don't know what race of people are at the stadium. That's racist. That's a great way to start. You're racist. No, you're racist, yeah?
Yeah. So, no, that's all I want to say, really. That's my introduction.
Well, that's really what happens at these rallies. I mean, political rallies, you get freebie stuff. We're going to have a DA person on the show. You think at the DA rally where they've got a street full of blue, you think a whole bunch of people didn't show up for a free shirt?
Well, I hope it's gourmet burgers as well. That's the DA, you know, they need to up the standards a little bit.
With those special food trucks, you know, because it's in Cape Town. So
yeah,
it's got to be like...
with churros and cinnamon and gluten-free croissants.
Right.
Because that's how it's done. I mean, you don't want like a polystyrene.
So what do you get in an EFF rally? You also get a shirt, right? And a healthy dose of like Karl Marx. Do they give the book out and make you pay for it?
I don't know if they can spell Karl Marx.
Going over your head as well.
Yes, you may very well have some lead going over your head. Well, that voice you just heard is our guest for the week. Enough of us talking nonsense. Our guest is very well known at the moment, certainly well known in general, but most recently well known for being just utterly unqualified to be in Parliament, really. And I'm not even sure if you're qualified to be on the show. I worry about this. John Steenhuisen from the DA. How are you?
Great to be here. Very, very well, thank you.
The worst intro you've ever had to any...
No, I've had a lot worse than that, I can assure you of that.
I mean, to be fair, we've had about, I don't know how many, 15, 20 PhDs on the show.
Yeah, this is what I'm saying.
So we had to
we've got to lay it down, you know?
So you're basically saying you're dumbing down the show today, and that's why it's...
Just for you, John, to make you feel comfortable, before we go into for the kill a bit later on. So, I mean, for those who don't know you, obviously you're the chief whip of the DA in Parliament, and I mean, that's it, that's your title, right?
That's correct.
So, bit of a shit week for the DA, don't you think?
I think we've had a great week. Absolutely great week.
All right, let's spin. Let's go for the spin.
I think we've had a great week.
Right, there was a billboard with a whole bunch of dead people's names on it. Marikana victims there, both on both sides.
And Esidimeni.
Esidimeni, life Esidimeni. And where else?
Children who had been
drowned and completely unnecessarily in pit latrines.
What size was this billboard? Was it like 30 kilometers long by 10 kilometers wide?
Well, given the outrage, you'd imagine it stretched between Durban and Johannesburg. Yeah.
Yes,
no,
well,
it was a relatively small billboard at the bottom end of Joburg.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know, this is the case. The ANC can shit the bed and no one cares. The DA farts and everyone loses their mind. So you're held to a higher standard. That's not always a bad thing. What do you say to the criticism of the billboard in terms of that it used, the names of dead people, that it's disrespectful? Some people felt, you know, people have this thing about respecting the dead. That it's just cheap politicking and all of those kinds of comments.
Well, I think it's a classic case of the problems we have in South Africa of just misplaced outrage. the outrage should be the fact that those people died at Marikana, mowed down by the SAPS. Those patients died under the Gauteng Health Department's care at Life Has Dominion. And those children died in government schools where toilets aren't provided and they fell into pit latrines. That's where the outrage should be. The outrage should be, where is the justice for the victims of Marikana so long down the line? Where's the victim for the families of Life Has Dominion? Did the Gauteng Health Department or the ANC ask any of those families permission before they A, mowed them down, B, neglected them completely at hospitals, or C, was unable to build toilets? I'd also say that you can visit any town in South Africa, any city, across the length and breadth of our country, and somewhere in the town will be a memorial that has the names of people who've either died in battle or have died from some other tragedy. Secondly, to make the point this, that those names were all published in the Farlam Commission report, the Zariti Commission report. They've been extensively covered, pictures of the victims, extensively covered in media. A billboard is just another form of media. And the point that we're trying to make on behalf of those families, of those people who've died, is that there's been no justice for them. And that's what should outrage us as South Africans. Not the fact that this billboard went up.
Sure. But Ramon, I can see something's on the top of your tongue.
And has been subsequently removed.
Yes, and of course, there's all this thing about disrespect for the dead. I would say it's mostly disrespectful for the dead to go and rip apart a billboard that has their names and write on the place where the names were. I think that's greatly disrespectful. But also, it shows absolute intolerance. We have freedom of speech and freedom of expression enshrined in our constitution, and provided it doesn't cross the threshold of hate speech, you should be allowed to share and impart ideas. It was Nathan Sharansky who made that famous test called the Village Square test, where he said your real test of a democracy is whether you could go into the village square and say whatever you liked without persecution or prosecution or a fear of reprisal. Well, here is a classic case of us putting together a political viewpoint, sharing it publicly, and it gets torn down. And of course, no one's arrested the perpetrators who damaged the billboard, who have threatened and impinged on our right to political expression in South Africa. And that should frankly worry every freedom-loving South African, because it starts with DA billboards, and then you've got to ask where it's going to end.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not the first time a billboard has been vandalized, so we've had this before with the Zuma Must Fall. That wasn't a DA billboard. That was a private individual who put that up. It would seem that if you're going to put up a non-ANC billboard, if it's not kind of yellow in the background, a picture of Nelson Mandela, just reminding everyone that we once had a good guy in our organization and some stupid slogan, it will get vandalized. I think, it's just standard to come with gun turrets now, so people can't access it.
Just one more thing about the death. It is quite weird for a political party like the ANC who grandstand at every single funeral ever to talk about their policies and talk about themselves at every stage possible. Even like Mandela's funeral itself.
Yeah.
They spoke about themselves all the time. To say that this is disrespectful to the dead, it is, the height of hypocrisy is, it never gets high enough because we're just so jaded at this stage.
What do you make of, I suppose, that, what Ramon's referring to as the jaded sort of view South Africans have on continuous government corruption, just ongoing and in every sort of sphere? But I'm thinking, you've mentioned the Farlam and Zariti commissions. I've made it clear very many times that I think these commissions are a load of nonsense. We have a justice system which I feel should deal with these people. Commissions seem like a way where everyone goes and they kind of, it's like group therapy. They kind of say, look, this is the bad thing I did. And sometimes they deny it, but they eventually, the judge acts like a psychologist and he gets it out of them. And then they go, oh, I'm really sorry and I shouldn't have let, mentally ill patients starve to death. And that was probably a bad thing. And when I get back from the UK where I'm studying some random degree, I promise I'll feel even worse about it. So that doesn't do anything for me. I as a citizen, I haven't suffered from these particular incidents, but I definitely feel for the people involved, certainly because of the nature of the Life Is Too Many thing, and because I have actually dealt with psychiatric patients, I can put myself into that position far better, and I think it's horrific what happened. There isn't any justice. Nobody ever goes to jail. We had a president. Sorry, I'm going on a little bit, but we had a president who sat in office for 10 years, and close to 10 years, and he nobody has gone to jail from his administration. Everyone now, business leaders, the president, current president himself, has admitted that there was wide-scale corruption, but nobody's been punished. So what do you make of the way we approach these problems and dealing with them?
Well, you know, when people ask me, what do you think some of the biggest problems are in South Africa, I can really boil it down to a couple of key things. But I always say to them, one of the biggest problems we have in South Africa is ANC. In this case, ANC stands for absolutely no consequences. Because every single time where there is an outrage, every single time we've had a significant abuse of public office or public consequences, very little happens to the perpetrators. And you still think we are yet to see a very senior politician go to jail and stay in jail. I mean, Tony Yingeni, I think, went through prison on stilts. He was out very quickly. But you've yet to see a single municipal official jailed. You've yet to see a single senior public office bearer spending serious jail time as a result of the actions, or any big civil recoveries. So often these commissions are actually used to buy government time from actually having to deal with a thorny issue. So you create the commission goes on for a year, 2 years. By the time it actually reaches its conclusions, either the perpetrators are gone or have passed away, as they did in the Sariti Commission and the arms deal. All the chief protagonists are gone. Nobody's been held accountable. The same with the Farlam Commission. Nobody's been held accountable in any significant way for that. The second thing, a point I do want to make about these commissions as well, in particular relation to the Zondo Commission that's currently underway, and everyone's tongues are wagging on this Basasa and the revelations that are coming out there. And it has not ceased to amaze me this week how everybody sort of acts shocked and outraged by these revelations, when in fact none of these revelations are new. They've been in the public realm, some of them for over 6 years. Criminal cases, I've lodged criminal cases on a variety of the Basasa matters. But the truth of the matter, the law enforcement agencies in this country, those responsible for prosecuting and bringing to justice the perpetrators, have sat on their hands and done absolutely nothing. Basasa should have been investigated and shut down by the hawks, by our courts, by the judiciary, by a whole slew of people who are employed to protect the citizens and uphold the law. A long time ago, and yet they've been allowed to carry on. Then when the revelations come out, the Zondo Commission, everyone's shocked and horrified, just like Cyril Ramaphosa's feigned surprise and shock and thanked the media for bringing to his attention the whole-scale issue of state capture. It's nonsense. He was sitting around the table when those decisions were being made. He's been at the heart of government for the last 6 years. It's impossible to have sat around the cabinet table at the Thule House as chairman of the deployment committee of the ANC and say you didn't know what was going on in state-owned enterprises, you didn't know what was going on with state capture. It's completely farcical.
Yeah, so he was in charge of deployment and he was in government at the time. So if he didn't know, he's completely incompetent and should be president. If he did know, he's complicit and shouldn't be president. So I mean, it's a catch-22 for both ways. But I mean, nevertheless, if you listen to some of our esteemed intellectuals that write in our newspapers, no, but he's a good guy. He's trying to wrench the ANC away from what it actually is, which is a rent-seeking, socialist-seeking enterprise, and it's going to make I don't know what they expect him to make of it. Let's talk about hegemony for a little while. So people look at the word hegemony, and then ANC hegemony is not just about capturing the state, as they've done through cadre deployment and due to the NDR. It's also about the acceptable ideas within a society, and they've done that extremely well. The ANC has managed to create propaganda where they are the icons, and this is just a slight blip in their historical struggle for democracy. All of it, which is essentially bullshit. So what do you make of these people who defend the ANC at all costs, who are not really ANC supporters in terms of memberships, but they just can't imagine South Africa without the ANC?
Well, I think they lack imagination. It's the same thing I said to Peter Bruce in an exchange we had on another environment, on another show, a while ago, said the problem with him is he just lacks the imagination to imagine South Africa without the ANC in charge. So these people can only see South African politics and the political issues of governance through the lens of the ANC. I think the most salutary lesson for them is precisely what's happening in Zimbabwe now. We look a year and a half ago, Mnangagwa was hailed as the Ramaphosa then. He was the new dawn of Zimbabwe, having deposed a despotic, corrupt leader. This was the new start for Zimbabwe. Everyone expected that there was going to be this massive outbreak of constitutional democracy. Well, the situation in Zimbabwe shows very clearly that you can change the driver of the bus. But if you don't change the direction of the bus will get rid of the bad passengers on that bus, you're going to end up at the same destination. That's where Zimbabwe is today. They are suffering because ZANU-PF as a party has not been able to be reformed or restructured. And so I would wonder how many people then were arguing, well, let's give Mnangagwa a strong mandate so that he can fix ZANU-PF. Well, you're seeing the end game of that in Zimbabwe now. Incapable of self-correction and capable reform because the organization has become so corrupt and so compromised through a variety of scandals over the course of the last two decades that it's incapable of self-correction.
Yeah, and what people don't understand here is that the decisions that ANC makes in terms of leadership is largely dictated by the communists, the SACP, the actual communists, and the unions. Who did Cyril bow to first? SATU, the most destructive force in this country by far. You know, people that have stolen two generations' education. He bowed down to the communists. The communists deposed of Mbeki and they deposed of Zuma because he didn't follow the NDR correctly. Both of them did not follow the NDR correctly. So why would he somehow be beholden to the commies and to the unions and then somehow be this bright, intellectual, business-orientated reformer? It makes no sense.
Well, I think he's a classic political chameleon who changes his color according to the audience that he's with. So when he's in Davos or with European leaders, you know, he plays down the whole issue of expropriation without compensation. He plays down issues of the nationalization of the Reserve Bank and, you know, jollies them along. When he's, you know, before a union audience here, Cyril the Chameleon, you know, turns a dark shade of red and, you know, you see the rhetoric that he comes out with and bending the knee, you know, to this Marxist-Leninist claptrap that they still are spewing out, even though that's been disproved in every country that's been tried.
I want to push back a little bit because you say they can't change direction. It's too sort of late. And I would argue, you see, everyone keeps arguing that what the problem really is that you've got a lot of corruption. And if the ANC could just get rid of corruption, there were just people who, you watched them, they had cameras on them all the time, so you couldn't be corrupt, and they just were good people, right? That would solve the problem. And I argue that wouldn't solve the problem because what you have is you have a bus that boarded at the station 60 years ago. And that bus, in the front of the bus, the destination was communism. Mm. That was the destination. And the people on the bus realized that, and the bus driver specifically, realized that it may take them a century to get where they're going, and they're going to have a lot of detours along the way. They might ride through crony capitalism on the way. But at the end of the day, their destination is their destination. It's their core ideology of the party. This is quite important because I want to talk about the core ideology of the DA later as well. And so you can have inverted commas good people. You can have inverted commas non-corrupt people running the ANC. That won't make a difference. And in fact, where we find ourselves right now is as a result not of corruption, but of where the ANC's ideology sits. What do you?
Yeah, look, I'd agree with you. Look, I mean, corruption's looted huge amounts of money. It's robbed opportunity from lots of people. But the problem at the end of the day is essentially a policy one and policy direction. And you can change sort of the people at the head of the table, but if you're still on this, on the wrong destination, you're on the wrong track, you're going to end up at the same failed state. And socialism and Marxist-Leninism, as we've seen the world over, leads to poverty, it leads to disinvestment, it leads to hunger.
It itself causes corruption because it cannot exist in a non-corrupt state.
So it's the problem is an ideological problem, and that, you know, the policies that the ANC want to pursue, and they were jollied along in the Mbeki era, largely by Trevor Manuel and others, to say, look, well, you know, we'll get to communism eventually, but you know, we've got to use gear, we've got to use all these other levers to get there. But the truth of the matter is that, like so many other things, the centre can't hold in the ANC, and it hasn't held. And so you've had this tug of war between, you know, the hardened socialist Marxist-Leninists within the ANC and what are called the sort of constitutionalist faction there. But what is it? You know, it is that conflict within that party between those factions that has actually led to this policy inertia over the last 2 decades. So you've got one half of the cabinet who says we've got to implement the NDP, we pass the NDP. You've got other half of the cabinet that says we absolutely will not implement the NDP. It's a neoliberal policy. We want the new growth path, the NGP, and you know, which sees more state control and state exercising control of the levers. And in that clash, you've ended up with essential inertia, which has cost us a decade of economic growth. It's driven 10 million of our people into the unemployment queues. And you have the same people now wanting to use the same policies to try and solve the very problem that those policies have got us into. It's complete political foolishness. And that's why I've been telling audiences, if you want to, one of my favorite politicians, Frank Underwood, says that if you don't like the way the table's set, tip it over and reset it. And that's what needs to happen in South Africa, because you can't solve the problems with the same people sitting around the same table making the same bad decisions. It's going to equal the same bad outcomes. So that's why Ramaphosa changing at the top is not going to change, you know, that essential dilemma within the ANC. And that's why you've seen this wrangling, you know, barely a day after the manifesto is released, there's wrangling in the ANC about what the manifesto actually says and what it means. Cyril saying one thing, Ace saying another. And it's that confusion and policy inertia that it's not going to get us on the road to growth and progress.
That's another point Gareth von Onselen, I think, actually recently made, is the ANC will release something that says, let's talk about the Reserve Bank and privatize the Reserve Bank being nationalized. And to one audience, as you mentioned with Cyril, to one audience or at the right time with certain media houses, whatever it happens to be, the message will be, we obviously don't want to nationalize the Reserve Bank, but we do want to look at the structure or something like that. So it'll sound soft. And so people who are really worried, or even slightly worried, the Max what's his name? The Max de Preers of the world, who kind of see the ANC can never do any wrong, but he's still concerned a little bit about this. He'll go, you see, they just want to restructure it. They don't want to nationalize it. And then, of course, speaking to, say, a group of the party's leaders or a specific faction, then the message will come out, we are going to nationalize the Reserve Bank because they stand in the way of our progress. So, and then what ultimately happens is the people who want to hear the positive message. The nationalization is never as radical as it possibly could be, but it still happens. And the people who were always on the positive side go, look, it could have been worse. And so we carry on. And we've done this repeatedly, again and again and again. I feel like we're doing it with EWC. We're going to end up at a point where they take away farms and unused property, and house owners go, you see, not so bad. I still own my house.
For now.
Well, that's the problem, slippery slope.
But the corruption thing really irritates me, because I think corruption is endemic anyway. But it's not, corruption is not the reason that we are in a recession. It's not the reason we are in junk status. It's not the reason that we are the lowest growing economy or the slowest growing economy in Africa. Those things were caused by non-corrupt people. Pravin Gordhan, communist. Rob Davies, communist. Ibrahim Patel, communist. It's Pravin that borrowed 2.7 trillion rand to pay civil servant salaries. It's Rob Davies that is put in severe restrictions and limitations that restrict trade, like BEE stuff. Like he's mad about BEE. Like it's Ibrahim Patel. I mean, let's not get into him. But it's people think that somehow the country won't be destroyed solely due to ideology. And that is completely wrong. It's happened before. It will happen again. It happens all over the world. Why can't we just say that ideology is rotten and they will run roughshod over everything and everyone who opposes it as long as the ideology is followed and they remain in power? I mean, I don't know why that is such a strange statement to make. And I'm called a fearmonger for saying that. Mm. But it is the truth.
Yeah, I would agree with you completely that, you know, we have very successful economies in the world where you have high levels of corruption still. It doesn't mean that they're not growing. It doesn't mean that they've got very high unemployment rates. It just means that they've got corrupt officials there. So I would agree with you in that regard. I think that what the corruption does do is robs opportunity and reduces your ability to exercise the levers of power to make life better for South Africans. But as I said, this bus is on the same trajectory, and repeating the same thing over and over again and following the same path is not going to change things. We need a fundamental reset in South Africa that's going to put us on a completely new trajectory. And it's not rocket science, but there's this romantic hold that the ANC have, and it's reflected in their attitude to Russia and the Soviet Union and their romanticism about Cuba and the bizarre statement by the SACP heaping praise on Maduro in the last week. It's reflected there. They just can't bring themselves to criticize an ideology and a set of policy choices that has completely failed South Africa and our people and failing government as well, because it's not working. And so what needs to happen is a fundamental reset and change in that policy direction of South Africa. But unfortunately, I think things are getting worse. And, people say, well, Cyril, we need to give him a strong mandate to stand up against the radicals and this radical policies in the ANC. Well, he's got a 63% majority now. And I don't know what's more radical than expropriating private property, than nationalizing the healthcare industry in South Africa, than restricting citizens' rights to self-defense, going off their pension funds, to nationalizing the Reserve Bank. These are very radical positions. And he's done that with a 63% majority. And now people crazily want to go and give him an even bigger majority in the next election. It's complete madness. It's also the antithesis of democratic accountability, because you never reward a party that steered the economy onto the rocks, pushed 10 million people into the unemployment queue, presided over the theft of hundreds of billions of rand of public money, and continue with corrupt officials in place by increasing their vote at the next election. That's not democratic accountability. I think it's going to be a big mistake, because if voters do that, and it happens, and people play with fire in that regard, if you think the ANC are arrogant now and are power drunk now, after an election where, despite all they've done wrong, there's no electoral consequence for them, I can tell you, you're going to see that go into overdrive after that election. The radicalism and the, because they're going to see it as an endorsement of these failed policies, and they're going to, rather than throttle back and change direction, they're going to push full steam ahead for an even faster implementation of this radicalism and socialism.
Why do you think it is that most South Africans who vote, at least, don't seem to see what you see? I agree with much of what you've said. And there's a lot of talk about the DA's messaging. But it doesn't need to be the DA's messaging. I think if you just read newspapers, you would come to some similar conclusions about the failures of the ANC. I'm trying to understand why they get 63%, why in the next election, based on current relatively reliable polling, they're looking to get at least 58. And that's still an overwhelming majority in a country where people have gotten poorer. Everyone. This is from the lowest, the poorest of the poor, to the wealthiest. Everyone has gotten poorer in the last decade. Everyone is worse off now than they were socially, financially, probably psychologically too, based on the country's status and the crime levels and all the other social threats. Why is it that the average voter doesn't see that problem?
It's hard to fathom, because you're seeing time and time again, and you see it reflected most notably in by-elections. So a community will go and burn down a municipal clinic because unhappy at the service delivery and unhappy with their councillor. There's a by-election. They either go and vote for that same councillor again, or they vote for the same party again. So I think that very few, well, not enough voters in South Africa see the causal link between their lived circumstances and the way in which they vote. And that's why you have people who are living in informal settlements and have for the last 20 years go blindly voting for the ANC in the next election. What's why you see when Jacob Zuma, despite the fact that he has caused suffering and harm to South Africa on a grand scale and presided over a vampire a government that sucked the very lifeblood out of the economy and out of government departments, gets rapturous applause when he walks into the ANC's manifesto launch in Durban. And I think people don't realize the causal link. And I also don't think people realize just how serious this fight that we are heading into, because the ANC and Cyril tend to present this very acceptable middle of the road facade. But what they're essentially doing at every single step is moving closer and closer to the outcomes of the National Democratic Revolution, which means they've got full control of not only the levers of state, but of all levers of society. They want the state and the party conflated to control people's lives. So what we're seeing actually are the frontiers of individual freedom being rolled back in South Africa. So whether it's your right to own property, your right to financial security, your right to choose the healthcare and how you choose to access healthcare, your individual choice there, all of that is being rolled back by the ANC. They are stamping out individual freedom in South Africa. And unless more and more South Africans get up and realize that this is actually the essential goal and reason the ANC exists, to get this complete conflation between state and party and then for complete control and dominance over South Africa, they're going to wake up when it's too late. We're going to end up with a situation like you have in Turkey at the moment. People say, well, it'll never happen here. Well, Turkey went from probably a model democratic country on the verge of admission to the European Union.
Yeah.
In 3 short years, it was a totalitarian dictatorship. And it just shows you how quickly it can happen. And more and more people need to wake up to what the real issue is. I think we get distracted by the leaves far too often. We don't actually see what's actually the wood in front of us, where the real problem lies going forward.
Yeah, but when you do say NDR, people just roll their eyes. Oh, just fear-mongering. But now, John, let's get million-dollar question now. Yeah. Why? Just what all you said, we all agree. I think most people listening to our show will agree with you. What's up with the DA? Like, just not taking advantage, or maybe are taking advantage? And are voters just tribal? Is the ANC that big of a cult? Is the DA failing to get a good message out? Like, what's happening with the DA? Because it doesn't seem, based on the polls we've seen, that the DA is doing much better than it was doing 5 years ago at this stage. So what would you attribute that to?
Well, look, I mean, I think it's a number of things. I think there's if you look at South Africans generally, there's a very strong brand loyalty, and it extends past politics. South Africans generally, by and large, find brands and they stick with them. I think the ANC have a strong brand. They've always portrayed themselves as the party of liberation, the party of Nelson Mandela and the like, and it is a compelling message. I also think that where the DA has gone wrong, and where I think we spent a lot of time last year in, is criticizing the government and not offering people an alternative. And so what you need to do, I think that everybody knows why South Africa is in the situation it is in. I think everybody knows who is responsible for us being in that situation. But what people are looking for now is, okay, how do I get out of this? And so what we have to do is firmly plant that ladder of opportunity in each voter's home and show them the ladder out of the situation they're in, reforming education, fixing the economy, a complete reform of our labor regime. And we've got to paint that ladder and each rung in it in voters' minds, because I don't think we've been good at setting out the alternative.
I mean, that's fine, but I just don't think like you're radical enough in your views. You don't say the reason you're poor is not because you don't have anything. The reason you're poor is because you don't have rights. You don't have property rights. The government controls everything. They control. I mean, people have been living in a Venezuelan type situation for decades in this country because the government provides them in what are these quotes called?
Air quotes.
They provide them with their monthly grants. They provide them with their shitty public health. They give them shitty schools. So people have been living in a socialist hellhole for decades. Why can't the DA say the government is the cause of your problems? What we want to do is to free you from the government, give you the rights to your land, the rights to choose your school, the right to choose your health provider, and make you rich. Now, why... For myself, the DA says we're just a better form of government, a better form of oppression as an anarchist or government is oppression. The DA is just a better form of government. Why not just say the government is a problem, we'll take it out of your life?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a difficult for a political party to go out and sell an anarchist or a libertarian view like that. It'll put us out of business. So we've
although you have been somewhat libertarian. Here's the thing, right? I think your messaging is just wrong because some of the things you've done.
I actually wanted to hear that answer.
Well, I'll have to let him finish. Okay, the libertarian thing you've done is you said you were going to take away a whole bunch of ministries. Okay, that's libertarian. It's not completely libertarian, fine, but it's a pathway there.
Yeah, well, I think it's about reducing the size of government, getting government out of the way. I think government, far too often in South Africa, is the obstacle. I think government is the obstacle to a good education system. I think government is the obstacle to people being able to use their labor and offer their labor how they see fit. I think government is the obstacle to economic growth because they make investing here, they make visiting here as difficult as possible through impossible regimes, silly programs, and frankly, absurd policies. So the more you can reduce government and get government out of the way, the better it makes things. And I think we've shown that where we govern in the Western Cape. We're unashamedly pro-business and pro-development and economic development in the Western Cape. And we go out and we partner with business. We don't treat business as some sort of enemy or some sort of group of people who need to be pushed at bay and kept out of the way. We partner with business, and that is why the economy has grown in the Western Cape, even in the midst of a drought, even in the midst of a economic meltdown in the country. The Western Cape government under the DA was able to grow the economy in partnership with business and create jobs, which is the complete reversal of what's happening in the rest of the country. So, I agree completely, and that's why the 15 ministries proposal is there. We've got to reduce the size of government, not only for the political reasons, but also for financial reasons. We currently spend a huge amount of money. The public service wage bill completely out of control, completely unsustainable. And unless we start radically rolling back government and reducing its size, and introducing far more efficiency and effectiveness, you're not going to be able to affect the change, and life actually gets harder for people. And I think that if you look at what's happened now with driver's licenses and the like, that's something I shared on Facebook yesterday. When a government makes laws and regulations that require you to have X license or Y permit, and then makes it virtually impossible to obtain X license or Y permit, you've got to ask yourself, is that government actually capable of delivering anything?
Well, I mean, Milton Friedman, no doubt.
Yes, of course.
Right. And what did Milton Friedman say? He said, if the government was in charge of the Sahara Desert, they would run out of sand. And I think that's very true. Would you like
another water?
Thanks.
All right. So
I'm enjoying this water. There's not much of it in the Western Cape at the moment, so it's a bit of a luxury. Thank you.
So I don't think we know why the message isn't getting through to the average voter. Because I really have felt that's a problem of messaging in the DA, but I think it's also a problem of policy. You bring up the Western Cape, and I agree with you with regards to the DA being business friendly in the Western Cape. That has helped investment and that has helped grow the economy there. You've also governed relatively well in things people like to see their government doing, filling potholes and supplying reliable electricity and the like, communicating relatively well with their citizens. That kind of stuff happened in Cape Town, more specifically when Helen Zille was in charge of Cape Town, and has carried on, but there have been problems. Those things have happened relatively well, but then there's also this weird streak in the party And I realize you're a party made up of individuals, and I've been told this before, and a broad church and all that stuff. We had a Gwen and Gwenya on the show, and she gave us the broad church talk. But when you start making policies which are nannying, they are nanny state policies, I think that those things turn people off. I think they turn your base off. I think the average voter is certainly not going to buy into a system or a party they don't have much love for in the first place. And then there's a nanny policy about when I can buy alcohol or a new license I need to put up a solar panel, which is none of your business because my private property and you don't own the sky or the sun or the solar rays. So those things seems like shoot yourself in the foot. And I just don't – I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, I mean, just into the solar one, my understanding is that it's a national government requirement and cities are required to get those licenses.
But come on, there's federalism in this country. The Western Cape should turn around and go, you know what? That's a bullshit law. Yeah. If you want to set up a solar panel on your own private property in the Western Cape, go ahead and do it. We're not enforcing the law. Frankly – You have no power to enforce the law. I mean, the entire discussion we have is a laugh in a way because you can do almost anything you want in South Africa and nothing will happen to you. We've discussed it on the show before, all the way up to murder. But most normal people aren't murdering each other. They are speeding, however. They are committing traffic violations all the time. People are littering. They're breaking basic bylaws. Who has not that I think you should need one, but who has a dog license? No one. None of this crap gets enforced. Some of it shouldn't be enforced because it's a whole load of rubbish. And some of it isn't enforced because in the Western Cape, you can't even stop gangs from killing each other because the SAP won't support you. So, or doesn't give you as much support as you probably require. So I just don't understand why this need to kind of make these extra rules, which seem completely unnecessary and are counterproductive to gaining support for the party.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think it is a difficult space. And, you know, I think that there's huge pressure, I think, particularly on municipalities when it comes to electricity generation and water generation, because often you're not allowed to use the word profits in government. The surplus that emerges is obviously used to cross-subsidize services for the poor. And so when electricity consumption goes down as a result of more people moving to solar, and in the absence of a national framework where, in fact, what government should be doing is subsidizing people to put in solar panels in their homes and getting as many people off the grid, you have exactly the opposite in South Africa.
Let them feed that electricity back into the grid and then give that free electricity
exactly
to poor
problem.
People.
There is no, and that's the big complaint of big business, people like Tongaat Hulett, who have excess electricity. They can't feed it back into the grid because there's no system for negotiation around what the pricing would be, how you would do it, when it would happen. And, you have a situation where it's completely, left in the air with no ability for people to do it. So you're not incentivizing people to do it. What government should be doing is incentivizing more and more people to water harvest, to move off the grid. But of course, this has a financial impact. And I think that's often the wrong way to look at things. But it is a reality, particularly for local government, about how it funds itself and how it is able to sustain the rollout of its services.
Yeah, I mean, so there's that side of the DA, which is the make silly rules. And
the
nanny state sort of party, which Helen Ziller described to us on this show as, the competent state.
Capable.
The capable state, which terrifies me, frankly, if that's what a capable state is. But and then there's the other side of the DA, which is kind of a split because it's been made clear, at least by newspaper articles, as far as we can trust those these days, that, there's a split in the party between a more sort of centrist, and now it's just called right wing because that's insulting, of course, split in the party and the left side of the party. And you get this weird ideology. Well, it's not weird anymore. It's the identity politics and postmodernism and all the mix of all of that seeping into the DA on the left, on those people who are on the left in the party, and really toxifying the pool. which is a party that was a liberal party, liberal in a classically liberal sense, and is now moving to liberal in a completely American sense.
Well, I would argue a social democrat. So to me, there appears to be a sort of, there's two broad factions, if you want, of the DA. There's like the classically liberal types, someone like you or Zach Imbele or Helen Zeller. And then you got the sort of the younger Bernie bros, as I call them, people who would vote for Bernie or Hillary Clinton.
No, they wouldn't vote for Hillary, too neocon.
Oh, no, yeah. People were very upset Hillary lost on Twitter. Very upset.
Yeah, yeah, but given a binary choice.
Right, right. And there's sort of, there's a mix of these two. So you got the old school guard who understand the literature, who's read the J.S. Mills, who understands the role of the state and how it functions. And this new type that couldn't find a home in the ANC because they were not cadres. They couldn't go to the EFF because they were not radical enough. So the EFF, the DA sort of accepted them because it was, let me be honest, because they're young and black. So it's, you know, it's a good for the party to have young black politicians in it. But they don't seem to have a keen grasp on what the DA is about. And you got these two groups, and I think that reflects in the leadership, where the leadership seems to be rather weak. And that impacts the messaging, and that impacts the way people view the party. I'm happy for you to say I'm wrong, completely wrong on all this. I'm not an expert of the DA, so to speak, but that seems to be the problem to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that there's some fair criticism, but I think that you've got to also be realistic. I mean, what is the point of politics and political parties? It's to be in a position to be able to get into power so that you can then implement your policies and principles. So yes, I mean, the DP was, the DP, the PFP, the Progressive Party before that were a cohort of really, a small cohort of really strong classical liberals. But the truth of the matter is that if the DA was to grow into a way that would be able to get into government and to start to implement your policies and implement alternative policies, it means you've got to become a bigger tent than just a small liberal club. Mm. And that's where the real problem in politics lies. And it doesn't only beset the DA, it besets all sorts of policies. So we, you know, are now a party that's moved from a 1.6% party to a party that now is a 22% party. And in that growth, a variety of people have been attracted to the DA. And yes, I think there are competing philosophies in the DA. I think there are parties made up of people who have different worldviews, but it's also not unique to the DA. So if you look at the Conservative Party in Britain now, there's a huge debate raging within them around Brexit. They've got completely differing views, but they're still able to come together as a cohesive unit. And I think that that what you need to look at is the values and the principles that underlie the party. And those haven't changed. So yes, there may be individuals who are in the party that are not necessarily classic liberals. And you may well find that some of them are strong social democrats. But if the party is to grow, we've got to become the broader church, bringing like-minded people together around a common set of shared values. That's the only way we're going to build a new consensus in South Africa. And so the party has had some growing pains. We've attracted people to the party that don't necessarily share the worldview and values. And I think we've had some unpleasant experiences with those kinds of people when there becomes a clash with the value set. But I'd like to think that at every time we've been tested, that we've held firm to the values of and principles of the party, of accountability, holding our own accountable, and that we've made the right decisions in the end. And I think that you know, we've got to be realistic. We want to get into a position where we're able to govern, and that means we've got to attract more voters to the DA. And you've got to do it, you know, there's some nuances, but when it comes to matters of principle and on values, you've got to stand solid and ensure that those values and principles hold out.
All right, so I used to buy this consensus argument, and then a few things happened. Brexit, Donald Trump, Bolsonaro, Orban, and I forget the guy in Poland. Sorry?
Salvini in Italy.
Mm. Salvini is Italy, yeah. Mm. None of this shows consensus. All of this shows that at least for now, the political movement, and I've used people on the right as an example, but I can use people on the left as the Democrats who took the House recently. Mm. Several very far leftists, certainly the furthest they've ever had. They just put a terrorist sympathizer onto their Foreign Affairs Committee, an anti-Semite and a terrorist sympathizer. So the consensus is not where politics is at the moment, in my opinion. You talk about the Tories. Yes. There are people that are pro-Brexit, there are people that are anti-Brexit, and that is why the Tories are currently polling lower than a man who should never get near the reins of power, ever. I'm not sure he should be allowed to drive a vehicle, okay? Because he may very well see someone he considers to be too wealthy and run them over, because that's what rich people deserve in his view, okay? And Jews also deserve that, and anyone who's not a worker also deserves that. So the reality is, I don't see that the consensus is where things are. I see that the bravery of what Ramon was talking about, where you take a position on things and you go, yeah, this is crazy. This we've never done before. You've never heard it like this. You've heard border security. We need to keep our borders safe. We don't want random people coming into our country. You've heard that. Everyone said that. John Kerry said that. Hillary Clinton said that. Bill Clinton said that. Bush said that.
Barack Obama said it.
Al Gore said that. Barack Obama said that. What you've never heard is, we don't want rapists in our country and we're going to build a wall. Now, I'm not saying whether that's right or wrong. I'm saying that that seems to be what people are resonating with. People are tired of the fact that anyone in any party can say the same tired stuff. They know it's a speechwriter. They know there's a team that's checked over this. And instead of Musi Maimane standing up and going, what we're going to do is, if you earn less than 10,000 rand a month, you're going to get a voucher on a card at the beginning of every year. On that voucher will be 25,000 rand for each of your children. On that card will be a voucher for every single member in your family for 20,000 rand in healthcare. You will be able to go anywhere you like and swipe that card. Now, that's radical. That's radical. That might resonate. That'll piss the hell out of anyone on the left in this country. It might even piss some libertarians off, because it's certainly some sort of social welfare system. But the point is, it's a position. The point is, it's a position. And I think that unless the DA moves somewhere and starts to understand that consensus politics is dead, at least for now, and you've got to stick somewhere. And this is why you get called ANC light. This is it.
But I would advance this to you then. When we do it,
yeah,
we get nothing but stick and outrage back. So I think the billboard...
Stick and outrage is fine. There's a man running the free world at the moment who has had nothing but stick and outrage for 3 years. Mm. Nothing but it. Yeah. Nothing but it. People making allegations that he wants to rape his daughter. People trying to scare his son. People trying to break his marriage, even though he's done some dodgy shit that could have done that itself. The point is... Forget the media. The media is not your friend. I don't know when the DA is going to learn this. The media is not your friend. The media in this country is far left. The Huffington Post closed down, for God's sake. Okay? I don't know what more needs to be said. The people running, steering the ship are on Jenny Munusami, Max Dupria, Andrian Basson,
and
Ferial Hafiji. These are the people controlling the media narrative. None of these people ever want you to be in power. You've got nothing to lose.
But that's what I'm saying to you. I think we did it this week. I think we broke the sound barrier. We said, okay, this thing's going to cause outrage.
Cool.
It's going to make people unhappy. But we're going to go up there and unveil this billboard. We're going to talk about crime. We're going to talk about a government that's neglected people. We're going to talk about a government that's, failed to, today, 20-something years on in government, deliver flush toilets at schools or some form of decent sanitation. And we did it. And I think it got the reaction that we wanted. That's why I say to you, some people have said we've had a bad week. I think we've had a very good week, because what you want with campaigns is precisely this. You want to break the sound barrier. You want to get your opponents on the back foot, and you want people to be talking about you. So, I think it was Oscar Wilde said there's only one thing worse than people talking about you, and that's people not talking about you. And I think that's the billboard this week, despite all the squeamishness from the softies on the left, has actually put a flag in the sand for the DA. And I think we're starting to rediscover that that boldness.
Yeah, I agree with you as well. More flags in the sand. Yeah. More flags in the sand and less backing down.
But that's exactly it. And then, you know, it's a point I make about politics and politicians. That's what's very important for politicians to be road signs rather than weather vanes. So a weather vane will twist and swing in the wind and turn any direction. If you want to be a real leader and a real politician, and in fact, if you want to look at history, the only politicians who've actually changed life and circumstances for the people they represent are those who've stood firm as road signs. You know, you look at how Thatcher was able to bring prosperity and turn Britain around. Criticize it all you like. The Economist doesn't put somebody on the front cover of their magazine and call them freedom fighter for nothing. You know, she expanded individual opportunity and she gave people their own homes. All the things the socialists hate and abhor. But, you know, she was able to do it because she was unashamed about it. She was a road sign. She wasn't a weather vane. So you contrast her with someone like Jeremy Corbyn now, who, you know, is a complete weather vane. He's you know, pro-Europe 1 week, anti-Europe the next week, pro-NATO the 1 week, anti-NATO the next week, friends with terrorists. He twists in the wind the whole time. So need more road signs in politics in South Africa and less weather vanes.
He's very strong against the Jews. So give him a bit of credit. He's strong on one thing. Anti-Semitism.
But he's soft where it matters.
but I agree with you. I agree with you, John. I agree with you completely. And I think you are a good example of that, right? With that bullshit about not a degree, even though you never said you had one in the first place. That sort of shit.
Sorry, I just laugh when you say that because it's just...
What?
The whole thing was just mad.
But that shit destroys people. And you only came out of it much stronger. So you are the type of person that can have that pressure redirected and give it back twice as hard. Why isn't okay, maybe the DA is going to start, hopefully, but why hasn't it been happening for like 20 years?
Well, I think it has been happening for 20 years. I think that we've had some strong leadership. I think we've had some. Do you remember the outrage when we put up that Stop Zuma poster? Do you recall the sort of public vilification that the DA got? We were called Swart Gevaar. My goodness me, if we'd actually stopped Zuma then. We're a different country today. And we were 8 years ahead of our time because, you know, 8 years later, you had thousands of people marching on the streets holding up Stop Zuma signs. So, you know, we've had this, we've been bold and unambiguous on key matters. Well, we've got to rediscover our reason to exist and why we exist and what we are trying to achieve in South Africa, which is to unite South Africans from a variety of different backgrounds and languages around a common set of values.
But with respect, you think you can govern this place? Because I think that is one fatal flaw. Because I don't think the DA can govern South Africa. I think once the ANC is gone, this place will not be unified under any circumstances whatsoever. Why not just fortify the Western Cape and secede?
He's only semi-joking.
The secret of politics is not to build factions or fractions. It's to unite and lead the whole.
No, it's not.
You've got to unite and lead
the
whole.
It's about building a base, marketing to that base, and being firm completely.
But the truth of the matter is that, you know, a Western Cape secession, I think, would be a very, very bad idea. I don't support that at all, the Cape Party's thrust, etc. I also don't think it's realistic. But I think that what we have shown is that we can actually govern. And if you remember, the people said the same thing about the Western Cape. They were going to make it ungovernable. The DA would never be able to govern. It would be years and years of chaos and unrest. Well, yes, there were a few weeks after the election where there were protests and a bit of sabotage and the like. But once we got down to the brass tacks and started demonstrating that we're serious about delivering to people, we're serious about turning the CBD around on reducing crime, we're serious about rolling out services across the city to people who have not had them before, and we started to yield those results, people came along with you. So people forget that in the city of Cape Town, when we first took over, it was an 8-party coalition. We only won with one vote and one party abstaining. That city now, council now, has a 2/3 majority precisely because people realize that, you know, we're able to govern better. If you're under a DA administration, you're more likely to have a job. You're more likely to have piped water and electricity and sanitation. You're more likely to have access to better public services, better schools. And that is the truth of the matter. So not only, can we govern South Africa? Of course we can. We've shown it where we've been given the opportunity to do so.
So I think you'll be able to in terms of abilities, but I don't think you'll be able to win an outright election. I think after the ANC, no one will be able to in the foreseeable future.
Of course not. And that, you know, that is therein lies the you know, the future of South Africa. I mean, we've got to break the logjam that is our politics, and we've got to imagine a society and a world in a post-ANC dominated government. And that's why it's absolutely essential that the DA grows and is able to build itself up so that we can, in future, be the part of a centre coalition that actually is able to bring the decade of strong, stable government that is required, and to have a sufficient majority to be able to, in Parliament, to break down these destructive policies, education, our labour regime, our economic policy, and be able to start putting South Africa onto that new trajectory. And that's why we have to grow. It's imperative we grow, because when you know the chips fall in a post-election environment, and you have coalition building, we've got to be at the centre and the heart of the coalition. We want to be the Tories, not the Lib Dems, in a form of coalition.
So two questions flow from that. Number one, I don't see any natural allies. Now, I'm not saying coalitions need to be an alliance in terms of you should believe everything, everyone, but I don't see any natural allies to the DA, because to me the DA is, despite all its fault, it's the only real Liberal Party perhaps in Africa. That's worth mentioning.
There are
that's
a couple worth
its, in but Ghana. That's worth its salt, right? That's doing something fundamental here. And I think shying away from that, as I believe you have done, my personal opinion, for the past few years, leaves the country weaker, but also your negotiating capabilities for a potential coalition in the future, you have far less leverage. If that makes sense.
Mm. Well, I think that, you know, if we're able to bring the ANC down, you know, and I think they're going to go down in this election, I think they will go down further in the following election. And I think they're going to start losing control and power at municipal level in far more municipalities around the country. I think that you know, we have to be able to be there to be the dominant force in an alternative coalition. What you don't want to do is to be playing second fiddle to, you know, a bunch of socialists or Marxists. And even when you're not playing second fiddle, it is difficult, as you've seen in Joburg and Tshwane and Nelson Mandela Bay with the EFF. Now, the EFF are not a natural coalition partner for us. I also don't happen to believe that our hinterland lies in coalitions with them in the future. I think what South Africa needs is a strong, stable centre coalition that coalesces around a shared program about change and a new direction for South Africa. I don't think that the EFF could possibly be part of it, because they want to take us down a completely different road. But that's not to say that you know, you can't find common ground. And I think some of the most, if you look at the most prosperous period in Germany's post-war history, was the decade of coalition between the SPD and the CDU. Now, they're completely different sides of the political spectrum, but were able to form a coalition around a shared set of outcomes that they wanted to achieve: economic stability, economic growth, creating employment, cleaning up government, and reforming the energy regime in Germany. And they were able to achieve it, even though they were on different sides of the political spectrum. So I think that the future will lie in coalition politics, but it's absolutely essential that the DA grows and gets stronger, because you want to be able to have the bulk of the chips that you put on the table when it comes to negotiating that, so that you can direct the, you know, where things are going to go and the broad framework of that coalition.
Okay, let's talk about the elephant with the strong jawline in the room, and that would be the leader of the party. Roman said, you know, you haven't had these strong sort of leaders. I disagree. I mean,
hold on, before you spread fake news.
Yes,
I said the current leader is not strong. Previous ones were strong.
All right, so you know, we've had, so Tony Leon, I think, can be credited with a lot of the growth of the party. Certainly, the growth and the growth trajectory. I think Helen Ziller proved the governance capabilities of the party. Both were very strong leaders. Both faced a lot of criticism during their time because they were those types of leaders who understood, in terms of my view of leadership, that democracy works up until a point, and then somebody has to be in charge, and somebody's got to bite a bullet, and that's the person who you've elected to be in charge. And at that point, it becomes an autocratic decision. They take counsel, and then they decide. And both of those people, very strong leaders in that regard. Helen Ziller is still fighting it out that way on Twitter.
Not without a fight.
Yes, and And that's great and all. Musi Maimane is a different character. No doubt about that before we get to what I think of his leadership. But he's just a different type of character. He seems to be softer a little bit in that sense. Not as aggressive, certainly. He takes a different approach to things. He wants to have sort of broad-based discussions rather. I think he's scared of offending people, frankly, except it would appear his original base, that he's not scared of offending, because one grumpy sports presenter storms off a set. But he's very different for the DA, as far as I can tell, as a leader. There's a lot of criticism about the DA and about his leadership, because the DA seems a bit rudderless, or has seemed a bit rudderless, certainly in the last 2 years. Musi, in my opinion, has made a number of missteps, although he does know how to deliver a good speech in Parliament. And now with the foe gone, you know, Jacob Zuma is not there anymore. Julius Malema is just basically a cigarette smuggler's concubine. And so now I suppose the flaws are more exposed. So, you know, you're a member of the party. He is your leader. And I'm happy for you to defend him, and I'm happy for you to agree with where you think it is. But what do you take of all the criticism?
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm Musi's chief whip. I'm appointed by him, and it's my primary job to defend him and defend the party. So, you know, you're asking a bird to fly here.
Cool.
But to say to you that, you know, I think each leader brings a different dynamic to a political party, and each leader has strengths and each leader has weaknesses. And you, as you rightly say, Helen and Tony before them, and other leaders before them, Eglin and the others, you know, have all had really good points, but they've also had blind spots. They've also brought certain brands or a direction to the party, and have been blind to other areas and that neglected them, which have been done by other leaders. Look, I know Musi. Musi's not only my leader; he's also a personal friend of mine. We're family friends, and I saw very early on something in Musi that I think represents the best of what the DA and the vision it has for South Africa. It's building a non-racial alternative. His story as well, I think, is a compelling story about how when opportunity are given to people, they can make the best of that opportunity and flourish in difficult environments. I think that is, his personal, his family story is a real South African story. And yes, I don't think he brings the cut and thrust and the sort of muscular liberalism that you would have experienced under Tony Leon, or perhaps, you know, sort of the Germanic orderliness of the Zilla leadership era. But I think he has got other strengths that I think open up other markets for the DA, who find, you know, the DA more palatable to vote for, because they have a leader who they see as, you know, is a different leadership style. So Musi is a far more consensus-based leader, and the decisions he makes are his own at the end of the day. He seeks advice from the federal executive and from the federal council, but Musi's very much his own man. And I really want to dispel this issue that, you know, Musi's my puppet or Natasha Mazzoni's puppet or James Self's puppet. I mean, Musi and I disagree vehemently on a number of matters. We have arguments on them, as a chief whip and leader should do, because I think it's in those tensions and in those discussions and debates that you actually come out with the right solution at the end of the day. So I think that Musi is going to be judged in this election, and the people will pass judgment on Musi. He had a very good outing in the local government elections, his first election as leader. We took over three metros that we hadn't before. I think that's a very, very good son. I think this election is going to be a little bit more difficult, and I think the electorate are going to pass judgment on both the DA and Musi's leadership. But you know, I don't see a man who is weak and vacillating. I see many strengths in Tony, in Musi that I never saw in Tony and Helen. I see blind spots in Musi that I don't see necessarily that sure. Helen and Tony had.
So I think my problem is I know things that I disagree with Tony on and things I agree with him on. I know the same things with Helen Ziller, having both, you know, followed those people for many years and spoken with them directly and personally. Now, I haven't spoken with Musi personally, but the problem is I don't know him enough. He doesn't stand out in any specific way. I can't go, you know what he's really strong on is this. It's like, I know he's probably quite strong on religion, okay? Which I actually think, I'm not a huge fan of certainly bringing religion into the state, but the point is a lot of people in this country are very religious. So if he would just stand up and go, you know, I'm religious and this is my belief, and I believe that we shouldn't bring religion into the state necessarily, but I believe that the lessons taught in the Bible, for example, are very relevant to how we live our lives and how we govern and how we treat each other, for example. And if you stood by that strong, I'd be able to say, cool, that's something that Musi stands for, absolutely, because he stood up and said it strong and hard, not he went to a church one day or something like that. Because those are the rumors, you see, that's what happens, is he does stuff or he says small things, and then there's like rumors and murmurings about what he believes or what he stands for, etc. And the thing about both Helen and Tony is they've both stood up very hard, and you know the things that they are uncompromising on. I don't know what Musi's uncompromising on. So perhaps that's a discussion at the federal executive, that Musi needs to be more sort of out there and more voracious about his views.
More intransigent.
Look, I think that you make some fair comments, but I would simply say this as well, is that unlike Helen and Tony, Musi's relatively new to politics. This is a new environment for him as well. He's very young. He's below 40. Mm. And, you know, politics has not been his life and existence as it was for Helen and Tony. So I also think there's a settling in period that leaders have, and, you know, they find their mark, and use that as a platform to.
I would have hoped he'd found his mark before he was leader of the party in a country that is in dire straits, to have a new leader, a new party, and so that's a worry. I mean, that truthfully, that's a worry as a traditionally a DA voter.
But I just want to make this point, though, that you see, and this is, I think, we obsess about personalities too much in politics without looking at parties. And that's where, you know, we end up with this cult worship of people like Zuma, and they become, you know, the reason for existence. And it's very difficult to distinguish the party from them. That this party that Musi leads is the same party that Helen was leading and Tony was leading. The same value set, the same principles, the same foundational core, program and values. And, you know, you should be less worried about, you know, what the leader says, but what the core values of the party are. Mm. And those hold consistently over through the leadership tenure of all the leaders that you've spoken to today, and Musi upholds and defends those core values as well. And I think that, I think he's precisely the type of leader we need to break the logjam in South African politics. I think he is a bridge builder, and I think that's his big strength. I think he is able to bring people together. He's going to be in Potchefstroom this evening in the Northwest to address this whole issue that occurred this week at Schweizer-Reneker. I think, and he really is. You know, if he owns one thing, I believe it's reconciliation, and something he lives, and something he, has been his experience over the course of the last decade of his life.
You can't eat reconciliation, I'm afraid. what is that point where you figure out that his tenure, he hasn't, you know, he's a failure? What stage do you say to yourself? I mean, I assume it's based on the electoral results. So I assume if you lose a few points, you know that, okay, we need to change course. So for the party itself, what is that failure point?
Well, I think that, like a company, we trade, but we trade in votes. And I think that, you know, you've got to consistently show results and show growth. The DA and the DP have grown in every single election since 1994 from 1.7% as I said to 22% now. And I think that, you know, your success as a leader and your success of leading the party is judged on how voters respond to that message. And so, you know, we had a situation in 1994 where, you know, we had a disastrous outcome. It was then required of Zak de Beer, and there were some uncomfortable discussions that took place at the time to say, look, mate, this is not a great result for us. You know, we've got to look at doing other things. But, you know, I think that this election, as I say, will people will pass their view about the DA and the future of the party on at the ballot box. And I think that, you know, every party then after an election has to take stock of where it's at and what needs to be done to grow the party further. I said after the local government elections where we Moosey had an exceptional outing where we were able to, you know, rest three metros away from the ANC and to grow our majority in Cape Town and to take over councils and far-flung places and in weird provinces like Limpopo where we now run municipalities. It was an excellent outing, and you know, I think it consolidated Moosey's leadership and gave him the confidence which he's building on. But you know, I think that there's no party in the world that doesn't take stock of electoral outcomes. I think the ANC took stock of the electoral outcome in this election before the election, which is why I think they got rid of Zuma so quickly, because they could see where things were heading. So you know, I think that leaders are judged by, and parties are judged, and party leaders are judged by electoral outcomes. And that's how they're held accountable, ultimately, by the electorate.
Do you think the DA is treated harsher, not just media, but by voters as well?
Absolutely.
Do you think there's a higher standard for you?
Absolutely.
Than others.
Absolutely, and I think we should welcome it. I think it's right that we're held to a higher standard because we've got higher ambitions for South Africa than what are currently there. And I just think that the prime example was the whole issue around the Dalil matter. So, you know, here's an electorate that screams for accountability and clean and accountable government. But, you know, when a party then takes action against a member of its party who had led to the city getting a less than satisfactory audit outcome, who an internal audit report and two independent investigations had found major leadership shortcomings from, and the party tries to take action against them, you know, we're vilified as sort of this terrible organization. But the point to make is simply this, is that, you know, it is hypocritical for us to hold the ANC accountable to a standard we are not prepared to hold our own people accountable.
Yeah,
and I think we got given an unfair ride there for what we were doing. Look, we made mistakes. We didn't handle the situation well, and I think we've learned a lot of lessons. And you know, I think that it's been upsetting to some core DA voters about the situation. But at the end of the day, and we've got to apologize for that. But at the end of the day, we can't apologize for holding our own accountable. Because the problem is that when you turn a blind eye to the small Inyana skeletons of your own people, you end up like the ANC today, just so completely moribund. Because at every single key point, they turned a blind eye, whether it was Sarafina, Viridine, arms deal, and Kandler Gate, Travel Gate, the Gupta landing. Every single time, it was a blind eye turn. And now that party is so compromised that Cyril actually, no matter if he wants to act, can't act, because everybody knows each other's small and Inyana skeletons. He knows theirs and they know him, and they can't move against each other, which is why the ANC parliamentary list to parliament looks exactly like it does. No change. The same people who created the problems are going to be going back to parliament where they're going to carry on, because nobody can move against them in that organization.
Yeah, it's roughly a bit of that the broken window theory in solving crime, where you solve the small, you don't let the small issues go away. Mm. If the window's broken, you fix it. Because if this window's broken, there's going to be graffiti the next week, then there's going to be defacement the next week, then vagrants the next week. But if you discipline and you keep the small things and you solve them at that time, it does work.
But absolutely, and I think that history's shown us as well in South Africa is that you've got two options when you deal with these things. You've got the ANC option, you can turn it and sweep it under the carpet and hope it goes away. But experience shows us these things never go away. And it's often then the cover-up that's worse than the actual original act. So public exhibit A in Nhlanhla Nene. You know, there's a guy, it wasn't the fact that he met the Guptas, the fact that he lied about meeting the Guptas that got him where he was. So, or you act and you grasp the nettle and you deal with it. And, you know, I think people, you know, voters should take some solace in the fact that, you know, when people don't live up to the values and principles and the expectations of the party, we will take action, no matter whether you're the leader, the mayor, a branch chair or a councillor, you will be held accountable. And I think we should welcome that.
All right. So there was a lot of trouble a while back. Well, I mean, media hype around who ended up in your FedEx, essentially. You had a conference and it basically came down to an identity politic issue. We very much in this country embrace identity politics, certainly around race. That's part of the historical thing, obviously, but also part of the way things are sort of trending in the world at the moment. And Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of criticism about the fact that there's white people. You know, yourself, you know, you're a white male sitting in a position of relative power. Oh, sorry to spring it on you. You know, and they're all those sort of, I think they're quite pointless arguments, but I'm interested to hear your view on all of this, because there's some people in your party who've echoed what the media has criticized you for, and have basically tried to make as if there's value to this criticism, that we should judge people essentially by the color of their skin and not by the content of their character.
Yeah, well, I think it's an exact antithesis about an open opportunity society that the DA is seeking to create, because what you do in an open opportunity society is that you look at individuals and you look at what they're able to offer. Now, you know, contrary to popular belief, I didn't have an option on the way out, which button to press, what color I was going to come out. You know, it wasn't an option I was given. So yes, I was born white. Does it mean my contribution to South Africa must be devalued, that I must sit in some corner and keep quiet and adopt a sort of sorry-that-I-live approach and live on my knees? Absolutely not. I'm going to make a contribution, and I've been unashamed about it. Yes, I'm a white South African. It's not something I can change. It's a simple color, a simple matter of melanin. And I really think that we dumb down the debate in South Africa when we revert to this racial characterization. I actually think that people like D.F. Malan and Hendrik Verwoerd would be very proud about where we sit with race relations in South Africa at the moment, because I think more and more you have politicians trying to get people to retreat into these racial lagers and cultural lagers and language lagers, because it's a sense of comfort. These are cul-de-sacs that distract us from being on the road and getting to the destination we want to be, which is a truly democratic South Africa where individuals are guaranteed their rights and guaranteed opportunities, not on the color of the skin, but by virtue of their citizenship. And I thought there was a point of 94 was for us to leave this racial narrative in the past. Our constitution says very clearly South Africa belongs to all who live in it, united in their diversity. And I think it's problematic when you've got political parties and political leaders who continuously seek to delegitimize people or their arguments based purely on their race. And, you know, I think pretty much if we carry on down the road we're going, and we're going to be doing things like reintroducing the pencil test in South Africa before you're allowed to have an opinion on anything. And I think that is the exact antithesis of what an open society, what an open constitutional democracy requires. What we should be doing is calling on the best efforts of every South African, no matter your skin color, no matter what God you worship, no matter what, you know, where you went to school, no matter the circumstances of your birth. If you've got a contribution to make, we want you to make it, and we want to build a South Africa that truly values the views and opinions and the contributions of all. This zero-sum game of dividing and ruling is really going to lead South Africa into a deep, dark cul-de-sac from which it's going to be very, very difficult to emerge from. And we've seen the end game of these racial policies. They end up in despair, poverty, and failed states.
Well, I agree broadly, except for communists. I don't think they should be allowed to hear their views. I'm happy to be at least democratic. But they'll throw me in a gulag, I think.
Fire up the helicopters, Ramon.
We should just preempt. I mean, it's expensive. Yeah, we need something. Hot air balloons. Yeah, we've got lots of air. I actually forgot the point I was trying to make. You see, you try to be witty, and then you lose the point you're trying to make.
Around all the race stuff. Yeah, I think...
Look, oh, yes, sorry. I do remember my point.
Okay,
sorry. If I may. I've found out, I heard this argument for a while now. A lot of people really like white supremacy in this country. Because I see people on Twitter, I see politicians. The whites are this. They've been oppressive for 400 years. They own all the money. The very institutions of democracy are you know, whiteness. I'm like, if I have to agree with that, I'm a white supremacist. If someone of another color says that, they're progressive and woke. Don't you find that weird? That's true, though. It's a white supremacist argument.
You're saying that the assumption is that white people are somehow greater than everyone else, they can do all this amazing stuff.
And people who listen, I know many white people, we are not that great.
Are you friends with white people?
I am friends with a few.
Okay.
All right. Some of your best friends are white.
Some of my best friends are they white though? I mean, they're mostly Jewish and European, so I don't know if they count as white. But
you see, I think that what has happened in South Africa, there's a number of conferences. I think we've got a really strong influence, particularly at university level, of this sort of critical race theory, and I think it's
absolutely
gathered a great deal of momentum on our university campuses. And
we're about to give a doctorate to Julius Malema in critical race theory,
which is producing these distractions from the real problems in South Africa. And I then also think race is a convenient scapegoat to failure. So when something doesn't work, or you know, you've pilfered money from your department and you're exposed, of course the first go-to is, as you saw Buttebile Dlamini in the last Sunday Times, where she said Musi Maimane was a racist for exposing the fact that she had mismanaged her department and been found as a delinquent by the Constitutional Court. I mean, it's ironic, a black female saying a black male is racist, but nonetheless, there it is. But it gets pulled out as this handy card because it is then seen as the trump card. So I used to play a game when I was young, probably a bit before your time. We used to have these things called trump cards. You used to have aeroplanes and cars, yes. And there was always a trump card in the pack. So with the aeroplanes, there was always the Lockheed Blackbird. I remember that.
Yeah.
And
the
S-71. Once you pulled that Lockheed Blackbird out, boy, you'd won the argument, and the cards were yours. And I think race is becoming the Lockheed Blackbird card in South Africa, where, you know, when you can't argue with somebody, and you see it so often on Twitter, as soon as you start to, you know, poke the argument or, you know, and deconstruct the argument, it's not a witty comeback or counter argument. It's you're this color, so you know, there it is, that's why you think this way. And as I said to you, I think that the race architects of the apartheid era would be very proud of where this country is at the moment with race relations. And the truth of the matter is, we really have been through tough times as a country, and I think we've got some really tough times ahead of us. But the times we've been able to overcome those adversities and those difficult times is really when we've stood together across the racial spectrum, across the language divide, across the cultural divide, and actually stood shoulder to shoulder to get us out of the situation that we've been in. And you know, if we continue down this path of dividing people on something as silly as race and the color of their skin, I think we're on a slippery slope to a failed state.
I must admit, John, like I cringe a bit when politicians say we should stand, you know, side to side and come together and kumbaya and all the rest of it. You need to win. And then when you win, your ideas are the ideas of that society in the amount of time that you win. If the DA shoots itself in the foot all the time now, with the Schweizer-Reneke stuff, right? It was started by a youth leader within the DA, who said, oh, this is terrible, one in South Africa for all racism must fall, etc. And then 24 hours later, he goes there and he says, oh, now I'm actually finding out what the facts are. That sort of shit, like, just destroys the accountability of the DA itself, and it plays right into the hands of your opponents, of your critical race theorists, the opponents. Why? I mean, if you just say straight from the beginning, you know, race doesn't matter, it actually doesn't exist in a fundamental sense at any scientific or biological level, we're not talking about race at all. We're only talking about solutions. We're only talking about economic growth. We're only talking about freedom. Am I wrong?
Or is it, well, or I think should it, you participate? I think it, in an ideal world, that would, you know, would probably be the ideal way to deal with it. But the truth of the matter is that the race dynamic and the polarization is a real environmental effect at the moment in South Africa. And I think that you ignore it at your own peril. Just about Luyila, I think there's been a great deal of disinformation about what was actually said and what the timeline was. You know, he did tweet a picture 4 hours after it had already gone viral on the internet, and then went out there the next day. But there's this disinformation during the rounds that he revealed the teacher's name, that he said a whole lot of things that he never said. It's completely untrue, and no doubt the truth is going to come out in the weeks ahead. But that being said, I do think that it is important, particularly in a fast-moving environment, particularly in a social media environment, particularly in the post-truth environment that we find ourselves, that it is always important to make sure you've got all the facts at your disposal before making pronouncements on things. And I think that it's very easy, you know, for for people to, you know, misinterpret situations. And that's why I think he did the right thing by going there the next day and having a look at the situation, assessing the situation. You know, he certainly didn't get suspend the teacher. He didn't climb over the wall and harass and terrify
children. No, not at all.
He didn't break the he didn't break the issue.
But he just exacerbated it without due process. And that's the issue. Because he's young. Okay, I get it, right? I mean, I'm not saying he's evil incarnate, but it's shit like that dilutes the message overall of the DA. And it plays right into the hands of the EFF and the ANC, like, all the time. I'm not in favor of social media policies, but something like that. I think that really irritates your base.
Yes, it does irritate our base sometimes, but I also think it, you know, it lets other people know that their views and their opinions are also shared and their concerns are shared by us. I think that anyone looking at that picture would have been curious about what is going on there. I mean, it does look odd. When I looked at it, I must admit it jarred.
Sure.
It did jar, and I think that, you know, I think it was natural for one to want to inquire, you know, what was going on here. But that's why I say it's always important to make sure you've got the full set of facts at your disposal when you're making an answer. That's why I think that the MEC's rush to suspend the teacher looks now like he suspended the wrong teacher. You know, the EFF, you know, wanting to jump over the school and destroy the school and burn it down and cause harm to parents just because they happen to be of a certain color, you know, is the exact antithesis of what building one South Africa for all means.
Okay, but clearly there's a social media problem in the DA. I mean, I think it needs to be said. No, you've got Helen Zille tweets about Singapore. I agree with everything she said. Okay, and I still don't think she should ever apologize for anything as it happens. But the problem is the DA runs an internal poll, which we never see the results of and no one will show anyone. And then they chuck Helen Zille. So you've now lost one of your strongest people in the party. And frankly, if she opened up in competition to you, you lose about 8%. Right. Then you've got Phumzile van Dam, who regularly goes on Twitter left, right, and center and says whatever she likes about anyone, including the two hosts of the show, calling us both racist, far-right, alt-right, etc., right? I don't have a giant base, but I'll get you a seat in Parliament on the show. That we're worth at least a seat. So, you know, come elections and I turn around and go, don't vote DA because Phumzile is an idiot. And you don't want someone like that to have a seat in Parliament. Frankly, if you lose a seat, she should be the one losing it. Now, then on top of it, you have Musi Maimane straight off the Ashwin Willemse. He could have waited for the facts, but he doesn't wait for the facts. He tweets out a stupid tweet. And then it comes out, two black CEOs sit down next to each other 3 days later and go, this is bullshit. There's nothing going on here. And it turns out there's nothing going on here. And now Ashwin Willemse wants to be a politician, right? And then you've got a youth leader who, obviously, I agree with you, the picture jars. I'm using the most known examples, but the picture jars. And he tweets it out. I get that he thought something was odd or whatever, but maybe he could have just waited like a little bit, like, or, you know, because I saw the picture and I waited. I didn't say anything.
Or ask a question in the tweet.
I waited, and within 2 hours, someone had seen the metadata of the second picture. So the thing is I don't necessarily need your comment here, but I know that people in the party are going to be listening to this. I certainly know that you're a thoughtful guy and you'll keep it in mind. You guys are shooting yourselves in the foot repeatedly with either your base or you're doing what Ramon says and empowering your direct opposition. When you engage in critical race theory, you are being EFF soldiers. That is exactly what you're doing. Anyone in your party who engages in this nonsense or who tries to amplify either a race or a gender or any of these identity narratives, you are playing directly into the EFF's hands, and they're better at you than it. They're better at it than you are. So what will happen is you will amplify it, and then they will run with it, and they will run you over. And so I just think that there needs to be a lot of thought about what's happening in that kind of space, because as far as I can tell, there's a lot of the DA does do good stuff, and they do say good stuff, and they where they govern, there's some good things that happen, there's some shitty things that happen as well. The point is that you keep railroading yourselves on social media unnecessarily. This latest example could have been completely avoided by perhaps, I don't know, social media training. Maybe all your, especially the youngsters in the party, need to go on social media training where people say to them, look, I can tweet something out and it damages me. It doesn't damage an entire brand.
This is an entire brand, actually.
Yes, which I'm co-owner of. But the point is when they do that as a counselor or a leader within your party, and it and people then identify the brand as having done something wrong rather than them. Because I know what you're going to say. Individuals in the party will do individual things. So, yeah.
I think that you've got to look at the lens through which someone like Loyola saw that picture. And, you know, we've got to take into account the lived experience of you know, his background and where he's come from, where, you know, he's also experienced being division and racial segregation and the like. So he saw that tweet and that picture, and, you know, he saw it through his particular lens. Now, I'm not saying to you that, you know, politicians should rush to condemn and judge. I'm not saying that at all. And I think, unfortunately, social media creates a perfect platform for these perfect storms of outrage to take place. And, you know, they very quickly, on both sides of the spectrum, I might add, you're able to whip up racial emotion. So, you know, if I look at some of the stuff that's come out of the Front National, and that I find it equally repugnant. You know,
absolutely.
The death threats against Loyola. And,
oh, there's a YouTuber that's a far-right YouTuber.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I think it brings out the worst on both sides of the spectrum. But, you know, I think that social media is a dangerous environment because, A, things move very quickly. You know, there's a post-truth world that we're living in, and I think the exposure of the advocate Barry Roux, and, you know, we find that this guy's been causing trouble for South Africans, actually isn't even a South African, using Twitter as a platform to stir up this racial hatred. It's ripe for it. So in the war, they used to have this this post on the wall that says, "Loose lips sink ships." So what we've had put up in many of our offices around the country is one that says, "Loose tweets sink fleets." And, you know, I think it's something that particularly politicians need to be very, very aware of. I know I'm very careful. I don't tell people to F off anymore on Twitter. Apparently, that doesn't go down very well. And sometimes, you know, you really have to restrain yourself. You know, sometimes you almost want to open a second account so that you can have a real go at some of the people. But, you know, I've just found the best way to handle social media is I put out, you know, what are my viewers. And, you know, I'll engage with people who are willing to have a proper engagement. I just ignore the trolls and the you know, the race baiters, because you're never going to win with them. They're not going to ever vote for the DA. They're never going to support me. You know, they've got their own perspective, and they must get on with it. But, you know, I think that we all need to be very careful about how we manage social media, because it's very easy for it to be manipulated by both sides of the political spectrum, the far right and the far radical left.
Let's talk. We've got to wrap up soon. We've spoken a lot about the ANC. You've spoken a lot about the DA. We've given you some stick as well. I hope we won't get the feedback that we don't.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it's fair stick.
Yeah. We don't push politicians. Mm-hmm. Although I must give you a compliment. You are one of the politicians who comes on the show and talks freely, rather than we feel like we're having this stunted conversation. But let's talk EFF quickly. I didn't want to dedicate too much time to them, because I think that they're a relative open book. It's very clear what they are. But they have shaken up South African politics. In the sense that, in our opinion, they've pulled the ANC far left. So they've gone with a very far left politic, and they've pulled the ANC with them. The ANC, in an attempt to gain some of that support back, has kind of followed some of their policies. I mean, EWC certainly was pushed, at least. It was on the ANC platter always, but it was definitely pushed to the front by the EFF. Julius has been he's been a character. He's quite a hateful little man, but you know, he's caused problems for all parties, I think. Where do you guys stand on the EFF and what their value is in the political landscape?
Well, I mean, I've got a completely different view. I think undoubtedly they shook up the parliamentary environment, but I think that the EFF and their policies and their approach to politics is terrifying, and I think is one of the biggest threats to our future viability as a democracy if they are to grow. I don't think they're going to grow in this next election, but nonetheless, I think that the policies they espouse are completely dangerous. They lead to the failed state. And you know, if you want to see the outcome of EFF policy suite, go and look what's happening in Venezuela, look what's happening in Zimbabwe and other failed Marxist-Leninist social experiments. It's a complete failure. But I also think that, yes, whilst they may have shaken things up, I think they've been given far too free ride in the political spectrum. So I can tell you, if the DA disrupted Parliament the way that it would have been an outcry. But also, the media have been so soft on them that they've allowed them to get away with the hypocrisy.
It's not even soft. It's their own advertising agencies.
Yeah, so they've been so sweetheart and they've allowed them to get away with hypocrisy. So if Musi Maimane or I stood up in Parliament and said, pay back the money, when you know I had a huge unsettled bill and owed the government money, if I stood up in Parliament and said the public protector's reports are binding and must be carried out, the only way you can overturn them is in a court of law, and yet I was the subject of a public protector's finding and the on-point debacle, I think that the newspaper headlines are screed hypocrites. But these guys have been treated like gods, like political gods, and frankly, way beyond what their values. And I think a lot of the people in the media are starting to now find out that when the old saying, when you feed a crocodile, hoping it'll eat you last, you know, you generally end up being eaten by it. But it's just amazing to see the hypocrisy that they get away with. So I do a parliamentary tour for people who come around to Parliament. Hopefully, the Renegade reports can come down and come and visit. And it always ends in the parliamentary parking garage.
I'd search the anarchists, definitely.
so it always ends in the parliamentary parking garage. And I always say, well, like, who parks here? Anyone looks, well, Jaguars and 7 Series ML. It must be the DA car park. I said, no, this is the EFF car park. And the hypocrisy that is the EFF, that they come to work in, you know, Louis Vuitton and Gucci and the like, and just before they go in the house, they flip on their red overalls and then pretend to be the champions of the working class. That is hypocritical. For them to come to Parliament and argue that you have to have a degree to represent people in Parliament when they're supposed to be the vanguard of the working class, miners and, you know.
No, that was a real misstep.
I mean, complete. I mean, when 4 of their own members don't even have matric and the majority of their members on their benches don't have any post-school qualification, that is the hypocrisy that is the EFF. But I think the biggest danger for me that the EFF represents is essentially the future for what's going to happen in South Africa. And I don't even think there's a two-nardering that's starting to happen with the EFF and a faction of the ANC. And it's probably best borne out by the most bizarre thing that happened in Parliament, certainly in the last year for me, was this out-of-the-blue suggestion from the EFF that instead of coming once per month to answer parliamentary oral questions, that the Deputy President, Didi Mabuza, should only come 4 times a year. And you've got to really ask yourself a question. Why would an opposition party want to lose the opportunity to expose arguably the weakest and most compromised member on the government front?
Decrease exposure.
That's because there is a deal being done, and you know Cyril thinks he's been clever by putting this red snake in his pocket and you know thinking he's jolling them along. There is a real present danger to his future leadership because a two-nardering with Mabuza and Malema, who are essentially the same, different sides of the same coin. They are rent seekers, they are power hungry, and their ultimate goal is to have their hands on all the levers of power so they can dispense
patronage. And they've both shown that they'll do almost anything
to get elected. I think that you...
Sorry, Ramon. Including murder.
Yes, including that. To have some sort of two-nardering, I think is a real threat to our future viability as a democratic country. And this is a salutary warning to all of those people who are buying into the Max Dupree, Peter Bruce line that we've got to strengthen Cyril's hand and give the ANC a strong mandate. When you go and vote and you fall into that folly and you play with that fire and you put your cross next to the ANC, not only are you not voting for Cyril, you're voting for Batsibile Dlamini, Nomvula Mokonyana, you're voting for Malusi Gigaba, you're voting for 10 years of looting. Not only are you doing that, you're giving them a majority. And I think you've got to look at trends in politics. The last 3 ANC presidents have all been pushed out before the end of their term and replaced by their deputies. Do you really want to give David Mabuza, A, the power to expropriate without compensation, and B, give him the power to a huge parliamentary majority, where essentially then every aspect of the constitution is up for discussion or debate. And that is the big lesson that people need to be very, very careful of when they think they've been clever by falling into this, you know, give Cyril a stronger mandate. You could end up giving a stronger mandate to David Mabuza. And this isn't Morkel's where you get a two-year guarantee. You're going to have to wait 5 years before you get an opportunity to take back what you've given out.
Yeah, I mean, the ANC is everything but impatient. They can play the long game like no one else.
I think the one thing, it's just a comment, not a question, but the one thing that the EFF understands, even if they don't understand this exact point, but they certainly demonstrated, is that politics is downstream from culture. And the EFF has picked up on a lot of zeitgeist in the country in terms of culture, in terms of people's lives and the way people view things. And they're playing that game. And I think the DA would be wise to play that game on the opposite end. You don't have to play the same game. It's the same game, but it's obviously not with the same pieces. But I think it would be wise to follow the same tactic. It harks back to what I was talking earlier about consensus politics not necessarily being the way of the future. Ramon, final thoughts?
No, none at all. I think the coalition's in Gauteng should have collapsed a long time ago, if I'm honest with you. EFF and DA together, it's just not working out. We were relatively supporters of Herbert Mashaba when he was appointed. I don't see anything in the past.
I see some worrying things.
I see some worrying things, actually. And I think I don't think the EFF is worth your time at all. I think it's best for the ANC and the EFF to completely fuck everything up, and then you can come save us in 5 years' time.
Yes.
And so, I mean, that's the only point I want to make. But another point, John, I really appreciate you coming in here and being as honest as you were. It's very refreshing. We have a lot of politicians in here, and it's difficult. It's getting blood from a stone to find out what they actually believe. And kudos to the DA. You're the only party that actually comes on here, other than COPE. COPE came on here. But ANC, EFF absolutely refused to come on here. And kudos to the DA. You do come on here, and you do go toe-to-toe with us, which is appreciated.
Let me just make a point about the coalitions, if I may,
go for
just
it.
In response to that. Look, I mean, you know, coalitions aren't perfect science, and they're like a marriage. You know, you sort of don't always get it right, and there's periods of conflict. But I think it was essential for us to break the hegemony of the ANC and to show voters that there is a link between how you vote and how you're governed, and that it is possible to vote the ANC out of power. So I would admit to you that, you know, being in coalition with the EFF has been very challenging, and they're a very unreliable partner. I think that they involve themselves in all sorts of things that they shouldn't be involved in, and I think they have made life very, very difficult for the DA. You know, they're not reliable, and we've learned some strong lessons about coalition management over the course of the last few years. But to say this, I think that, you know, it's a quintessential question in politics: compared to what? So yes, Joburg, you know, perhaps has not been able to deliver the massive, you know, change that we would have liked to have seen to now. But I certainly think the green shoots are there. I think things are changing. And compared to what? Well, the trajectory of both Tshwane and Joburg under the ANC's burgeoning corruption and maladministration was leading to direct failure and direct collapse. Now, it's very difficult in 3 short years to turn around 20 years of mismanagement and corruption. But I think that Herman and Solly have made some great steps in, you know, trying to regain confidence, investor confidence in the cities. Both the investment grades in both Joburg and Tshwane have been improved. Of course, it's difficult to improve service delivery. And the way the city was designed, particularly Joburg, it was deliberately broken up into all these entities because it then massively expanded the opportunity for rent seeking. I think what Herman and them got to do is put the city back together so that you have a consolidated service delivery focus and you're able to turn things around a lot quicker. But of course, I mean, it's a lot easier when you've got your own majority, because then you've got your hand on the throttle, you can push full steam ahead and implement your policies and bring the changes. And I think that if you look at what the DA was able to do in Cape Town after, you know, particularly after we got a solid majority, was we were able to move things on a lot quicker than when we were in that messy eight-party coalition before. And I think that there's a lesson there, you know, sort of about strengthening the DA's hand so that we, you know, we've got a bigger a hold on the throttle and we're not being beholden to the whims and fancies of smaller parties. But I think it showed people that, that for me the most important things were two. One, that you showed people that the ANC could be out of government and that you can imagine a post-ANC world where, you know, the, where they're not in government. And B, we're able to stop the ATMs that essentially Joburg and Tshwane were being used as. And I think that's going to be massively useful to the DA in the Gauteng election particularly because you've cut off two big centres of patronage and thievery for the ANC. And I think that's why Gauteng is so competitive now. It's precisely because they've lost those two key centres of power here in Gauteng. And that could well be the key for us hurting them very badly in this next
election. Yeah, so just quickly, what do you think Solly's chances? Because Solly resigned today as the mayor of the executive mayor of Pretoria, or Tshwane, sorry, whoever I offended with either of those. And I mean, I'm not sure why he resigned. I don't really understand that fully. But the point is he's resigned. Someone, I assume, will take his place. He seems, I would guess, he's quite confident of a victory if he's resigning from his position. What's the forecast there? Because do you know something we don't?
Well, look, Gauteng is looking very – there's two provinces that are looking very, very good for the DA at the moment outside of the Western Cape. And Gauteng is obviously the prize and the Northern Cape. Gauteng has been in play for a while, which is why we made the decision to relocate our head office up to Gauteng. So we've got a footprint here to use the two metros as a springboard, like we used the city of Cape Town to go on and win the province away, you know, using that delivery model. So, you know, our numbers are telling us that the ANC are in serious trouble here in Gauteng, that there's a very real prospect we could bring them below that 50% mark. And so Solly's made the decision now that it's impossible for him to campaign full out for the premiership and do good by the city in Tshwane. So he stepped down. The DA will elect a new mayor, the council will elect a new mayor.
Caleb Kachalia.
Are you not taking Caleb away from me in Parliament? Caleb's a very good member of my of my National Assembly team, and I'm not going to lose him. So you know, they'll elect a new mayor, but it gives Solly the opportunity to really go out now and engage with the communities. And Solly is very good at that. I mean, I worked with him on the ground in the Tshwane election. He's got a really good charisma. He's got a good connection with people on the ground.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, the more people we can get him in front of without the strains of having to manage a city, a very difficult city manager and a very difficult political environment, I think the better foot forward we're going to be able to put to make the case for why we need to have a strong showing here in Gauteng.
Only problem is that if he wins the premiership and the DA, though, still drops in the national vote, what happens when he resigns to become the leader?
Well, of course, I mean, these are, you know, that's a great thing about the DA. And, you know, I think that, you know, we need to be commended for that. We have open contestation. We have congresses every 3 years, and anybody can put their name forward to be the leader of the party. You know, we opened that opportunity up for everybody. And, you know, we've had challenges in leadership races in the past, and I think that, you know, we've done them in a dignified way, in a democratic way. No one's thrown chairs, no one's been shot, no one's had a brick thrown through the back of their head, you know, no one's been stabbed. And I think that speaks well to the internal you know, political democracy that is the DA and is, you know, is exemplified by our election process and our list process.
Right, John, an absolute pleasure. Thank you. Almost 2 hours of conversation.
Any last words from you?
Well, I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to be with you guys. I think that the democratic space, you know, needs to be expanded far more in South Africa, and we need to find innovative ways to be able to have these conversations. I think the more South Africans talk, and the more we engage, I think the stronger we are you know, as a democracy. And so, I hope that that the show goes from strength to strength, and that the platform expands, that we can keep these conversations going. People must talk. We must keep the space open.
John Steenhuisen promotes alt-right podcast. That's the headline on Monday.
That's probably the headline. More like, we'd love to have more parliamentarians on all sides of the aisle on the show, because I think nobody benefits from those 5-minute segments on ENCA or whatever
or
it is.
Or on Eusebius' show.
Or on Eusebius. Well, no one benefits with Eusebius, but that's a separate discussion. And as you say, good long conversation, and that's really important. As always, you can support the show if you'd like. We've moved away from Patreon. We're still there, but not really promoting that. PayPal, if you're interested. Our website's launching soon. We'll also be launching with a donate link.
And subscribe to our YouTube page.
Yes, YouTube channel. The moment Ramon's been doing most of the content. Click the bell so that you get notified.
Excellent
and all
content,
the rest
I might
of that
add.
Stuff.
Very excellent. A lot of preparation hours and days and weeks.
And as always, we appreciate you listening. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at @Renegade_Report. We'll catch you next time. Cheers. Bye.
This is CliffCentral.com.